Welcome to Late Night Poetry Jam on KKRN Community Radio. I am Pamela Spoto, poet and host.
In my heart, in my brain, on my tongue, behind my teeth. Behind my eyes, on my tongue, under my skin, in my heart. In my veins, under my skin, behind my teeth, on my tongue, on my tongue, on my tongue.
We are broadcasting from KKRN Community Radio in Round Mountain. We will host a monthly poetry show the very last Saturday of the month at 10 p.m. So here we go. And we have a wonderful guest with us on Late Night Poetry Jam. And our guest is Lucille Lang Day. And welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I'm really excited because I've been reading your poetry, looking at your collections, reviewing your background, and I'm intrigued. So this is going to be wonderful. And I'm going to tell our audience right off that Lucy's background just covers an enormous range of study, and it's very fascinating. So I'm going to begin with reading a short bio because I can't remember all of the numerous awards that she has won and the different kinds of collections and chapbooks that she has written. So I'm going to tell you a little bit more about her. Lucille Lang Day has published 10 poetry collections and chapbooks, most recently Becoming an Ancestor and Dreaming of Sunflowers Museum Poems, which won the 2014 Blue Light Poetry Prize. She's also co-editor of the anthology Red Indian Road West, Native American Poetry, and I think, from California, as well as the author of a children's book, Chain Letter, and a memoir, Married at 14, A True Story, and we're going to make sure we get to that, which received a Penn Oakland Josephine Miles Literary Award and was a finalist for the Northern California Book Award in Creative Nonfiction. Her poems, stories, and essays have appeared widely in magazines and anthologies and have received 9 Pushcart Prize nominations. And that's not a little thing, Pushcart. The founder and publisher of Scarlet Tanager Books, she is, and I hope I pronounced this right, she is of Wampanoag, British, and Swiss-German descent. And furthermore, I'm going to let you all know, she has numerous degrees. And I don't normally talk about these, but I was so intrigued by them. So I'm going to go ahead and share with you her various studies. So she received an MFA in creative writing, an MA in English, which is not unusual, right, for a poet, a BA in biological science, an MA in zoology, and a PhD in science and mathematics. And so that's about Lucille Lang Day. So we're going to continue, and I do want to mention that at the hopefully towards the end of the show, we're going to be looking at her memoir, Married at 14, A True Story. And Lucy, you've been doing a lot of publishing. I mean, this Married at 14 was 2012, Becoming an Ancestor, 2015, Dreaming of Sunflower, 2015. And then you have another collection, 2016, that you co-edited, I believe.
Yes, that's right. Red Indian Road West, the Native American anthology, just came out in January 2016. So the past 9 months or so have just been very, very busy for me with publishing. It's been exciting.
I can imagine it's very exciting. And then you, too, are a publisher. And I know that your collections have been published by numerous different presses, but you have your own as well, which we're going to talk a little bit about as we go on. And I want to go back to Married at 14 just for a moment because it is so intriguing that I believe when, I know we're going to talk about this later, but when you were 12 years old, you decided you were going to leave home and get married at 14. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. I decided, I just wanted to get out of adolescence. I just wanted to skip it altogether and be an adult.
And I have a photo from something on Google of you at that time. And you know, you have the big hair, and I mean that in a very positive way, because that was the style, you know. And I think you're holding your daughter at that point, because I think you had your daughter when you were 15. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so we'll be talking more about that, because that is just so fascinating. So we're going to begin with Becoming an Ancestor, which again was published in 2015, and I really like the format of Becoming an Ancestor. It's really wonderful. So would you like to say a little bit about that, and then we're going to hear poems from Becoming an Ancestor?
Okay, yes. Yeah, well, the poems in Becoming an Ancestor are about my ancestors, my contemporary family, my childhood, my descendants, which currently are my four grandchildren, and also the poems are about mortality.
Yes.
So that's the arc of the book.
And I really like how they fit together when we think about format and models of collection. It's just lovely. So why don't you go right ahead and read us some poetry?
Okay. I'll start out with a poem about my father called Dad and the Gypsy. My dad has fallen for a gypsy woman with olive skin, red nails, and shining eyes. Her kiss at Safeway took him by surprise as he studied the label of a soup can. She said, "I'm sorry to hear your wife died. We ought to go to dinner and a show." That sounded good. Although he didn't know who she was, it was easy to decide to write his number on a slip of paper and hand it to her. The next time they met, they saw a showboat and shared a banana split. "I'm an interior decorator," she said, "and I've designed three hotel rooms in Reno. Let's go pick up my check. We can share a room, a king-sized bed, deck, and kitchenette, just like a bride and groom. There's just one thing I hope you'll understand. I need to borrow some money from you before we leave. $15,000 will do. When I get paid, I'll give you $30,000. Dad replied, "Ask them to mail your check." But he wanted to hold hands and kiss again. He loved her leopard dress, dark hair, smooth skin, and thought her crystal ball might bring him luck. For dinner on a moonlit night in June, she cooked shrimp and he brought Chardonnay. She said, "Dick, I don't want to dismay you, but I need an operation soon." She showed him a cigar box filled with cash. "I have $30,000, but the docs want 20 more. He loved her jasmine scent, but caught a sudden whiff of rotting fish. Her messages don't ask for his forgiveness. He hasn't answered yet, but he still yearns for all the little things one never learns to do without: red nails, a leopard dress." And that's a true story about my father. And while he was dating this woman, and at my recommendation, he did not give her any money. But while he was dating her, an article came out in the San Francisco Chronicle. We live right across the bay from San Francisco, saying that the FBI had broken up a ring of gypsy criminals who had a scam where they would track widowers, and the gypsy women would marry the widower, and as soon as he signed over all his assets, the other gypsies would kill him. And it's just like a science, well, it's like a horror novel, because you know, they buried the men's bodies in the basement, and they kept collecting the social security for these men who had been killed.
Did you write a poem? Have you written a poem about that?
So I didn't no, but I've written a short story.
Oh, okay,
That includes that aspect of it, because it was scary when my dad was dating this woman, but fortunately he got through it without, and ultimately just stopped returning her phone calls.
And I think that is such, and I'm not going to talk very much because I want to hear more of your poems, but I think that that is such an unfortunate situation, especially when people get older and lonely. And I have a relative and a friend who didn't have the wherewithal not to give the money. And so
they were really taken.
So as you were reading that, I was going, oh my, you know, how does this truly happen? That's a wonderful poem. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome. And now since I've read one about my dad, I'll read a poem about my mother.
Okay.
And this is also from Becoming an Ancestor. My mother, I finally see what Dad saw in her, not the apple-shaped woman with full dentures at 50 and a 40s hairdo in 1962, not the nag I scorned at 14, but a slim girl with firm breasts, fabulous hats, and a new dress for every occasion. He felt he was dating a movie star. She had dark hair and high cheekbones, was part Wampanoag, with hazel eyes concealing who she was and all her longings. She charmed him, chatting easily about nothing. She loved the World's Fair on Treasure Island in 1939, laughed at chipmunks fed deer from her hand at Yosemite, and kissed my dad, he later said, deeply and honestly. I wish I could have been there to see their joy before he gambled away her inheritance, and her disappointments grew round and hard, bitter fruit that dropped to the earth and rotted, filled with seeds. So that's my mother, and she was a very unhappy, disappointed person when during my lifetime. And part of it was due to my dad gambling away her inheritance, but also she had just had a very, very difficult life. Her mother died when she was 6 years old, and she and her sister and her brothers were all separated. And then her mother's adoptive parents brought her to California when she was 12, and she never saw her father again. And she only saw her older brother one more time on one trip she made to Massachusetts. So I think that in addition to being angry with my dad about losing her money, I think that she had lifelong depression. Shall I read a poem about her brother, my Uncle Fred, whom I never met, that tells more about that family background of tragedy and separation?
Yes, yes.
So this is called Uncle Fred. The farmhouse windows reflected flames the night he set the barn on fire. Nothing mattered but the hiss and roar blue-hot fountains shot from the roof. He'd lit a cigarette, let ashes fall in the hayloft, felt satisfied when the empty barn lit up the night. Still a kid, he didn't care what happened. His mother was dead, his father working far away, his twin sisters gone from him, his baby brother boarding on a chicken farm upstate. He knew the fire wouldn't bring them back together or do any other good. The flames could be seen all over a Acushnet. That was enough. The barn was saved, but even so, his father's parents, who'd taken him in, said yes when a couple across town offered to adopt him. I have a snapshot of him standing in a driveway 20 years later, his arms around my mom and aunt, pipe dangling from his mouth, the last time they saw him. He worked in a shoe factory all his life, never married, died at 60 and was buried not far from his parents and the barn he almost burned down. It collapsed 80 years later, leaving just weeds and the foundation. I've seen what remains, known his anger and grief.
And Lucy, I'm going to make an announcement, and then we're going to come right back, and we will talk about that poem. For our audience, this is Late Night Poetry Jam on KKRN.org. I'm Pamela Spoto, poet and host, and with me for this hour is Lucille Lang Day, poet and writer. Okay, so Uncle Fred had a tough life here.
He did. He was about 11 years old when he set the barn on fire.
Wow.
And
go ahead.
Yes, and so I think that he had a like my mother. He had lifelong sorrow too. Their mother died in the flu epidemic of 1918-1919, and she died early 1919. And then the family was just permanently separated.
And that does happen sometimes, and that's a very, I mean, it seems as a culture, sometimes we do get separated and alienated and live our lives in sometimes happy ways and sometimes not so happy ways. That is true.
Right. I think today there's probably, you know, that families still do get broken up like that.
Yes.
But I think now, if there are four children and either both parents die or one dies and the other can't take care of them, there's more, you know, the social services system and everything makes more of an attempt to keep kids together and at least in touch with one another.
Yes, yes. And so what I think the next poem that you're going to read is I Always Knew It. Is that correct?
Yes, and my mother, as you got in the poem about her, was part Wampanoag, and she didn't talk about that when she grew up. The people who raised her, whose names were Frederick and Mary Hazard, taught her that being part Native American was something to be ashamed of, but somehow I always knew it, and she finally admitted it to me when I was 23. So this is my poem, I Always Knew It. I knew it at four when I ran for the creek every chance I got, and my uncle called me the wild Indian as I slid down the bank, then leapt from stone to stone to reach the other side. I knew it when my parents threatened to give me back to the Indians if I didn't behave. I didn't care. I wanted to meet the Indians. I knew it as I rooted for them in all the old westerns and lamented when they lost and were cast as the bad guys again and again. I knew it when my Native American studies teacher said, I think you're an Indian, and when my aunt told my mother, tell her the truth, tell her what she wants to hear. I knew it at 23 as I stood at a dusty crossroad on the Rosebud Reservation. It was stamped on my mother's high cheekbones and woven in her dark hair. It was clear as the difference between flat redwood needles and the scales of a giant sequoia, clear as the difference between the musical chirps of Wilson's warbler and the soft hoarse whistle of Brewer's blackbird. I could feel the people of the first light stirring inside me with each contraction of actin and myosin fibers in all my muscles, with each nerve impulse as sodium rushed into my neurons and potassium rushed out. I knew it all along. I knew it before I could prove it with a DNA test, long before I'd heard of Wampanoags. I always knew it by the stick-like body of the Tule Bluet, the silence of the lynx chasing rabbits for food, the silvery needles of Sitka spruce and the yodel-like laugh of the common loon. I knew it was true.
That's a lovely poem.
Thank you. And then I'd like to read one more poem about how the Native American ancestry came into my family. There are a lot of poems in Becoming an Ancestor about specific real ancestors of mine, and this one is called Anjanette Sampson, Dartmouth, Massachusetts, 1880. 30 years old, live-in housekeeper. She'd never wed or loved a man and didn't think she ever would. But that spring, the Indian came to plant parsnips, leeks, and corn, feed chickens and milk the cows on the Hazards' farm for a fraction of a white man's wage. Her breath quickened each day when he arrived. She noticed his muscles, cheekbones, long black braids, and he accepted the coffee she brought to the barn. The Wampanoags lived in shacks by the pond outside of town. She'd never been there, but knew the Indians were nearby and poor. He brought her flowers, stones, and shells, said he was the sachem, his people's leader. He loved her, he said, but they couldn't go away. She gave birth to a daughter the following year, wouldn't tell the father's name. The Hazards fired him, but said she could stay. So that daughter that was born to them was my mother's mother, my maternal grandmother.
Oh.
And Anjanette named her Rachel Emma. And that's the that story of Anjanette Sampson and the Wampanoag chief was passed down in my family. And then in about 2004, after my mother's death, I had a DNA test that showed I am indeed one-eighth Native American. And since then, I've gotten in touch with the Pocasset Wampanoag tribe, which is the tribe that lives near a pond near Dartmouth. And they are helping me trace my Wampanoag ancestry.
It's really amazing how we may or may not find out these things, and you were able to do that, and when you read, I mean, in this first stanza, I mean, diversity. This is what just blows my mind. Diversity is so beautiful, and I just the whole notion of treating people badly because of their ethnicity or whatever the case may be. But as you read that, I was just seeing how beautiful he was. You know, through her eyes. You know, his muscles. Cheekbones, long black braids. I mean, I just that conjures up this really beautiful picture of him.
Yes, and the Wampanoags are very beautiful people, and they were described by the early trappers and pilgrims in North America and as the most beautiful people they had ever seen.
Wow.
And so I'm glad that, you know, now I can be proud of my Wampanoag ancestry. And unlike my mother, you know, I want to broadcast it rather than hide it.
Yes, yes. Well, because we have many poems here that I really want to hear them all. I don't want to run out of time. What would you like to read next?
So this collection is not only about ancestors, as I said earlier, but about descendants. So I will read the title poem of the collection, Becoming an Ancestor, in which two of my grandchildren appear.
Oh, good.
According to the dictionary, I'm not an ancestor yet, only a grandparent of a blonde boy who clomps in his new sandals, then throws me a ball strewn with black stars and moons on a white background, and a bow-legged baby girl with blue eyes, all smiles today in her hooded carrier, a child born the day my own grandfather would have turned 130. He never knew he had grandchildren, let alone great-greats. My own toddler days of warm cookies, crayons, and Betsy Wetsy dolls don't seem far away, but I am en route to becoming an ancestor. Lucy and Ricky are dead. Barbie is past 50. Even the hippies are history. When my grandchildren show their grandchildren my photo in an old album, I wonder what they'll say. That I swore like a trucker when I was hurt. Blue like Vesuvius when I was mad. They might recall I was always late, never learned to knit or crochet, had brown hair, couldn't cook worth a damn but could carry a tune, took poetry books everywhere. liked to know birds and insects by name, overreacted in both bad and good ways, was unreasonably vain for someone my age, had legs like a crane, and liked to dance.
You know what we, how we remember people, that is, that captures, you know, that notion, all the different possibilities. So did you really swear like a trucker?
Yeah, Mike. unfortunately, yes. And my daughter got very angry at me one Passover when I was chopping an onion and I sliced my finger along with the onion and the you know, I hollered some words and she came rushing in. The children have never heard those words before. I mustn't do that around them.
I can relate. Okay, good.
Okay. So then there's some poems in the book about my childhood about growing up in the 50s and 60s. So I read one of those?
Certainly.
This one is called I Remember, and it's a list of literally a list of things that I remember from the 50s and 60s. I remember red machines that dispensed nickel cokes in glass bottles when my dad filled his 55 olds. Leaving our order for the milkman using tags that stuck out of a bottle on the back porch. Begging my dad to trade in the old blue and white olds for a 57 Chevy Bel Air with fins. Being warned to stay away from the round washing machine with the external wringer. Always getting tagged by Karen when we played kick the can in the middle of the street. The red plastic hula hoop I twirled on my skinny hips longer than my cousin Jan. The purple print and sweet scent of mimeographed math drill sheets that Mrs. O'Gara handed out. My keen disappointment when air raid drills were discontinued. No more ducking under desks. The Mickens black dog, Lucky, running through the neighborhood and pooping on the sidewalk. Having a crush on Elvis Presley and buying Love Me Tender on a 78 RPM record. The doctors who came to my house and pulled thermometers and shots from their black bags. Playing with the X-ray machine that showed the outline of my shoes and the bones of my feet in green. Ratting my hair on top into a 4-inch dome and gluing it in place with hairspray. Making out at drive-ins while incredibly boring black and white movies played. Girls who liked sex being called nymphomaniacs and girls who refused being called frigid. Police dogs attacking and fire hoses spraying people who wanted equal rights. Using a slide rule and being told a girl could never be as good as a boy at math. Being told that girls only go to college to find a husband and should always let the boys win. Deciding to beat the boys at math, drink beer, smoke grass, and take on the lies in my gold lamé pants.
I have to smile. I was smiling all the way through that. I do need to make a show ID here.
Okay.
Then we're going to come right back to that poem. I'm Pamela Spoto, poet and host of Late Night Poetry Jam. With us tonight is Lucille Lang Day, poet and writer, and we're having a very good time talking and listening to Lucy's poetry. This is KKRN.org. You know, as you were reading this, I was, because my great-grandparents had one of those wringer washing machines, and that's exactly what they said. Don't put your hand in there. You know, your arm will be pulled through. You will be flat, you know.
Right, or don't get too close. Your hair will get stuck
yes.
in there, and it's all over.
And also, you know, ratting the hair. I mean, that was such a, that was the thing to do, you know, and the hairspray. I mean, that was just, I just had to smile at all of those. You know, but I did want to ask you a question about this whole notion about girls can't be good at math or science and kind of steered away from that. And I had wanted to ask you, is that another reason that possibly you went into science and zoology and mathematics to as a response to girls can't do that?
Yes, I was very, by nature, very rebellious and very contrary. And so my response to that was, oh, yes, they can do it. You know, I even co-authored a book called How to Encourage Girls in Math and Science. And then supposedly minorities weren't as good as white people at math and science, and
yes.
You know, that's also was nonsense too. And so I also edited a curriculum in health and biomedical science aimed at minority kids in fourth and fifth grade.
Mm-hmm.
So I really, that was one of my projects as a science educator, was to encourage the underrepresented people to go for it in math and science.
And that is a wonderful thing to do, because often, working in education myself, often young people believe what they're told about their capabilities, and it's unfortunate that we give them such limitations or place those stereotypical limitations on them. I believe you were going to read two more poems or several more poems from Becoming an Ancestor. And is that correct?
Yes. Do we have time for that? Or maybe I should just read one more and we should move on to Dreaming of Sunflowers.
Well, I'm thinking that too, because I want to make sure we cover everything that we would like to cover. What I liked about Delinquent Sonnets particularly is that takes us way back in time. And to me, this somewhat what connects to your memoir and what was happening in your life, you know, in your early teens and so forth. So why don't you go ahead?
Okay. So this is Delinquent Sonnets. In juvenile hall, new juvie has bright paintings on the walls to celebrate the better things in life, nature, growth, transformation. These murals admonish, graduate, put down your knife. Mustard-colored cells are stacked in tiers, windowless, with built-in cots and stools, where teenagers alone confront their fears and contemplate new ways to break the rules. The year I was 13, I ran away from home and landed here. Back then, my cell had a window. I could watch grass sway on a hillside, hear jays and warblers call. More pleasing than a work of art to me, a glimpse of sky, a hummingbird, a bee. Wild kid, I finally have become the proper girl my mother always wanted me to be. I don't smoke hash or grass, wear mini skirts, pick up long-haired tattooed men, or party till the neighbors call the police. My last drunken binge was 1970. My motorcycle riding days are past. I haven't shoplifted since 63. Oh, Mama, what's to become of me? I've no regrets for anything I did. The mescaline, the baby at 15. Inside, I'll always be your wild kid. I'd gladly wear those mini skirts again if I had the legs I did back then.
I really like that poem.
Thank you. Really
like that poem. It's great.
So that kind of gives a lead in to my memoir, Married at 14. Should I read?
Sure. Why don't
a little bit from the memoir?
Why don't we do that, and then we'll see how much time we have left, and then we will go to Dreaming of Sunflowers. But there are also some other questions that I wanted to ask you, because you have such wonderful material here, you know, in also with the Red Indian Road West. So, yes, let's go to the memoirs. And can you tell us a little bit, because it's so intriguing, that your age, you know, at 12, at 14, 15, 16.
Okay. So at 13, I ran away from home to L.A. and then went back home to Oakland. At 14, I got married in Reno. At 15, my first daughter was born. At 16, I divorced my husband because he hit me. He promised never to do that again, and I still felt I was in love with him, so I married him again when I was 17. And then when I was 18, I wanted to go back to school. I'd been out of school from the time I was 14 until I was 17, and he didn't want me to go back to school, and so I divorced him again when I was 18.
Good for you.
And he wasn't a high school graduate himself, and I guess he didn't want me to get ahead of him.
Yes.
So I'll read a little bit from the chapter Married at 14. This is the fourth chapter of my memoir. When I'm arguing with my mother about wanting to get married. So this is the beginning of that chapter. In her slip and corset, my mother was not a pretty sight. Even in the corset, she was shaped like a potato. It had real bones in it, or at least she said it did. To my thinking, any amount of hunger was preferable to needing such a thing. Unpacking her suitcase, she picked up a floral print nightgown that I thought only a very old lady or very little girl should wear. Watching from the bedroom doorway, I said, "Mark and I want to get married next month." "What about school?" Putting dirty clothes in one pile, clean ones in another, she didn't look at me. It was mid-August. School would be starting soon. "I don't want to go back. It's boring." "Your father wants you to wait until you're 16. She sniffed a blouse, then put it on the to-be-washed pile. I studied the bedroom wallpaper. Its pink roses on a green background had always looked old-fashioned to me. "If you don't let me get married, I'll run away again or get pregnant." I'd said this so many times it was sort of a mantra. "I'm not bluffing." My mother turned to look at me. "You look awful with all that black stuff on your eyes. Mark may think you look pretty, but I don't. Will you sign for me?" "I'm tired," she said. Her voice was sharp, more angry than tired. Kennedy was president, and the civil rights movement was underway. For many people, it was a time of hope, opportunity, and change. But Mark and I had a vision for our lives that one might have expected of teenage apprentices and servants before the advent of universal education. The first week of September 1962, we applied for a marriage license at the Oakland courthouse. When I told the clerk the year I was born, she thought I'd made a mistake. I said, "It's not a mistake. I'm 14. And so that we couldn't get a license to get married in California. And we ended up going to Reno. And in Reno, both of our mothers lied for us. So that they lied about our ages so that we were able to get a license there and get married. And I think his mother did it because my parents lived in Piedmont. They were not rich. We lived in lower Piedmont, but his parents probably thought that my parents were more affluent than they really were, and this was a good move financially for him. And my mother, I think, was just worn out with my saying I was going to run away or get pregnant again, run away again or get pregnant, and then she thought that just letting me get married was preferable. So I'll just read two more paragraphs about the day that we got married. On September 8th, 3 months before my 15th birthday and the week before I should have started ninth grade, the sky was a luminous blue as Mark and I entered the First Methodist Church in Reno. Our mothers asked the organist to play "I Love You Truly." I'd have picked "Love Me Tender," but I wanted our mothers to be happy. Standing at the altar, I found it hard not to giggle. Mark looked so skinny in his rented navy blue suit. When I knelt, I thought my tight-fitting dress would rip, but it held. I stood again, and Mark put the ring on my finger. I knew that many people would call me a fool, but I was incredibly happy. I thought ours was a unique and wondrous passion. Antony and Cleopatra, Elizabeth Barrett and Robert Browning, F. Scott Fitzgerald and Zelda, step aside. Mark was the prince, and I was his princess, and our wedding would fulfill the promise of our extraordinary love. Afterward, we all went to Lake Tahoe for steak dinners at Harvey's Wagon Wheel. Other than me, the women at the table came in matched pairs. Ellen and Judy, Mark's mother and stepmother, were redheads with sarcastic senses of humor and the worldliness of women who worked outside the home. My mom and Aunt Ethel, badgering the waiter with endless complaints, were identical twins, just over 5 feet tall, who wore short and size 14 dresses over their corsets and told and retold the joke about the woman who pulled a sugar cube from her brassiere, then asked her guests if they'd also like cream. Mark's stepfather, Pete, a large man with a square jaw, ordered drink after drink and stood up to toast Mark and me each time a new one arrived. Mark's dad, Tom, and mine, masticating their steaks, said they felt lucky. At first, I thought they were referring to Mark's and my marriage, but as the conversation continued, I realized they were talking about blackjack. So both of our dads were gamblers. So that's a little bit about the beginning of my adolescent marriage. And I really wanted to get married. I was in elementary school. I had been one of the kids who'd kind of been picked on and bullied, and so I didn't like being in school, although I was a good student. And then I also had a very difficult relationship with my mother, possibly because she'd had a difficult life herself. She was just always angry, always complaining, always nagging. And I just wanted out of adolescence, out of childhood. I just wanted to be an adult and get married and have my own baby. But, of course, I found out that only made life more difficult.
And it probably didn't help that your father had spent her inheritance, in terms of her sadness and her anger, your mother.
That's right. I think that she had all this sadness and anger having lost her. But really, she's not lost her mother through death and her father through moving to Massachusetts and the adoptive grandparents wouldn't let her correspond with him. She didn't get back to Massachusetts until after he died. So she lost both parents when she was a kid. She lost her brothers, their relationships with them. And then my dad comes along and loses her money. So she was, I think that it was just too much loss for one person, and it made her a very unhappy woman.
Yes, yes, that is a tragic situation, that kind of loss and loss after loss. And I do need to make an announcement, which I'm going to do right now. I'm Pamela Spoto, and this is Late Night Poetry Jam. I'm the poet and host, and with me this evening is Lucille Lang Day, poet and writer, and this is KKRN, Community Radio. And Lucy, I could be a minute or so off, but I think we only have about 12 minutes left. So,
oh my gosh.
Or maybe 15 minutes, I think. The engineer is signaling me.
So what should we do?
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you some questions that are really intriguing to me, and then maybe we can go back and read several poems from Dreaming of Sunflower and maybe something from Red Indian Road West. Let's see how the time goes, and we can just read right up until the end. So I did want to ask you, because I always find this really interesting about how writers write and and a writer's life. And, you know, sometimes I write every day and other times I don't write for long periods of time, or something, I read something or I hear something on the news and I just can't, I can't shake that, whatever it was. And then I start building a poem around it. So I had wanted to ask you about how and when you write, and also the fact that you are married now to a writer, and how that all comes together. And I was curious if you two write together or you just are very separate in your work. So why don't you tell us a little, Lucy?
Okay. My husband was a journalist for a long time, and he even had a best-selling nonfiction book. He's now writing poetry and fiction, and I write fiction and nonfiction and poetry, too.
Mm-hmm.
And we both work in home offices, and we have our own home offices that are our side-by-side bedrooms. We don't show each other in-progress drafts, but after we complete a draft, and it might be a preliminary draft, or it might be a first draft, then we show each other the work we've done, and we give each other feedback. And we, you know, and I think that both of us feel that the other is, you know, a very helpful critic. And we have never been able to write together, though, to collaborate on something. And the one time we really tried to collaborate was just on one sentence in a guest book at a B&B. And after about quibbling over adjectives and what we wanted to say for about 45 minutes rewriting and rewriting this sentence, he just threw up his hands and walked out the door and said, "You do it." and after that, we realized that collaborating was not the way we were going to go.
That is too funny. That is really too funny. Because sometimes we might think, oh, yes, two writers, they could just sit down and write together and collaborate and talk, you know, and do all of that. But that's not necessarily how it works.
Right. So, no, but I think we're very helpful to each other.
Uh-huh.
And I think he never, you know, he was strictly a prose writer before we got married.
Mm-hmm.
We got married in 2002. And I think coming to my poetry readings and reading my poems and poetry books, it inspired him to write poems, too. And so now he, too, has published a collection of poems.
Well, good for him, huh?
Yeah. And neither of us writes every day. And I never have I've never had a regular schedule for writing poetry. When I write poetry, I just work on it when I hit with something that I feel like I have to write a poem about, when I'm moved to write a poem, when I get excited about something. But when I'm working on prose, whether it's a short story or something longer like my memoir, then I will sometimes. I'll write every day. I might write every day for weeks or even months.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the time, I don't write every day. I spend a lot of time on the business side of writing, keeping up my website, doing readings, you know, proofreading books, and organizing my poems that I've already written into collections and submitting them.
Yes.
So all of this stuff takes up a lot of time.
And it sometimes that is so difficult for the creative person, let's say the poet, to also have to handle the business side of it, and sometimes it fits well. It's just, for me, sometimes the business side gets very, very tedious. And you have also Scarlett Tanninger Books. Would you like to talk a little bit about that?
Yes. I have a small press called Scarlett Tanninger Books. So far I've published 15 books. I publish poetry, fiction, creative nonfiction, and literary history by West Coast writers. And I've published just one poetry collection of my own. The other 14 books are by other people. And after publishing that one book of my own, I decided I'd rather find other presses for my own work. And it's partly a matter of, it is a lot of work to publish and promote a book and try to get publicity and readings and everything. And when you're when somebody else publishes your book, you've got somebody else who's really behind it too and wants to see your book be a success and is right there with you. And it's much more fun and gratifying than being the only person who's trying to promote your own book.
Yes, and I noticed that that you co-edited a book called Red Indian Road West, Native American Poetry from California, and you did indeed publish that. Since we're talking about that, would you like to just take a couple of minutes and talk about that book and maybe read one poem? I think we're down to about 8 minutes left, so I want to make sure that we have time for you to read as many poems as you like.
Okay. I'll read one poem from this book, Red Indian Road West. And this is the first anthology that includes poets from California tribes and also from the Native American diaspora in California, because there are many people in California from tribes nationwide. And this is true for Indian tribes all over the country. A lot of the tribal members get relocated in places that are far away from their homeland. And
yes.
So California has more than 720,000 Native Americans, which is the most of any state. And so I felt like it was really important to publish an anthology of Native American poetry from California. So I'll read one by a Concow poet whose name is Linda Noel. She's the former poet laureate of Ukiah. And this one is called Winter Within. Winter glimmers before me, lonely, shoulder down, hip angled. I am part my grandpa who waited for first snowfall before leaving Willow Creek, part my mother who helped push her father's car from snow-covered red dirt ditches, part my grandma living snowbound in pine country, part my father who walked the miles to town sledding food back to grandma's cabin. Winter draws its shawl about us. Salmon's fall run has faded, acorns have dropped, and mushrooms have found light. I look into winter and know that no frost can freeze the spirit. No thousand winters of ice could extinguish the flaming heart of my people. And so I like that. It's a very affirmative poem.
It is, and especially, you know, I'm looking at that last stanza. I mean, it's so full of perseverance and hope and carrying on, you know, that the flaming heart of my people, that's really beautiful.
Yes, and Simon Ortiz, who is a very well-known Native American author, wrote a blurb for this book, and I'll just read the beginning of his blurb because it captures something about the collection. He says, Red Indian Road West is an assertion and a statement saying, we have always been here. You will not forget us. You cannot do so. And I think that's a lot of what this collection is about.
Yes, and since we're at the point where we only have 4 to 5 minutes left, I do want to say that, and we're going to get to several more poems, but I want to make sure that our audience knows that your books can be purchased at Amazon, they can be purchased from your website, and Doug Bennett, our wonderful engineer, will be archiving this show, and there will be a paragraph or two about you, and your website will be listed there, so people can click on that and find out more about your book. So that's wonderful. So should we go back? Would you like to go back to Dreaming of Sunflower? and end with something, or however many poems we can read in our short time left.
Okay, we'll see what fits. All of the poems in Dreaming of Sunflowers have to do with my visits to museums and historical sites. And the subtitle of the book is Museum Poems, and I'll read one called Last Day in Amsterdam. We make love in our room with 15-foot ceilings and a vinyl Rembrandt behind the bed, then lunch on leftover sandwiches. Afterward, we buy fusidic acid for pink eye at the apotheque on the corner and almond cookies at a bakery nearby. Walking to the Hermitage in chilly May wind while dappled sunlight pokes through clouds hanging in low bunches, as they often do here, I keep my hands deep in my pockets so my fingertips won't turn white. The canals lined with black, red, pink, gray, brown, and beige brick houses glitter everywhere the thin light strikes them. The paintings at the Hermitage are by Rubens, Van Dyck, Jordaens, and Teniers. Dancing peasants, witches cooking, and wilted tulips please me more than biblical figures, kings and queens, and all the dead fish. Tomorrow we'll board a train to Paris. Thin blade modern windmills, enough propellers to lift the whole country, will be turning. Sliced by irrigation channels, the flat green landscape will quickly slip by. I'll remember dodging bicycles outside the mellow yellow coffee shop with its hookah in the window, climbing steep stairs to the small dark rooms of Anne Frank's secret annex, and watching women in bright bikinis with jewels in their navels beckon from red light windows while talking on their cell phones and smiling, maybe feeling sorry for all the dowdy women in blue jeans who also do it every day but don't get paid.
That's got a great ending. I'm just going to check here a moment. Do we have a couple of minutes left?
Minute and a half.
Do you think we should try? We only have a minute and a half left, and probably now a minute. So, what I want to do is I want to thank you. We might have a short poem there that we can get in, but just so I'm able to thank you so much for being on this show, and your collections are wonderful. Your poetry is superb, and this has just been really good for me. So, what would you like to read to finish up?
Okay, thank you, and I've really enjoyed talking with you. I'll read a short poem called The Two Fridas after a painting by Frida Kahlo that I saw at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art.
Okay.
An artery binds the two Fridas, one whose heart is split open, revealing chambers like nests where tiny snakes could hide. The other with a heart that's whole, a great ripe fruit on her purple shirt. The artery sprouts outside the women's bodies from a photo of Diego in the left hand of the one whose heart is whole. The other, her white dress torn, tries to stanch the flow of blood onto her skirt. Conjoined twins bound to one man, they sit side by side, hand in hand. The artist can't let either go.
That is an amazing poem, and I think it captures a lot about her, and she was a fascinating person and an artist. I want to tell our audience that I've been talking with Lucille Lang Day. She's been reading her poetry and her memoir, and it's been wonderful, and thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
You have been listening to Late Night Poetry Jam on KKRN Community Radio. I'm Pamela Spoto, poet and host. Late Night Poetry Jam plays the last Saturday of every month at 10 p.m. Keep tuning in.